On this episode of Skeptico.
One of the great things about Pizzagate is that it really cuts through a lot of the ambiguity with the evil kind of moral good bad question. Because sex crimes against children are evil, clearly evil. So in that way, it really makes clear the question, what is the nature of this evil? Is this evil something we just cook up in our consciousness as an illusion brain? Or does this evil tell us something about this hierarchical nature of consciousness?
Had I not been undercover, had I walked past them and heard these men talking like that, I would have thrown them off the railing. I mean, it was so disgusting. It demonstrated to me that parents were providing eye candy for these pedophiles and these sick perverts. I don't know how anyone, just as you had said earlier, Alex, how can anyone say that is not evil?
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science and spirituality with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and the topic of today's show is not one that's easy to talk about, and not one that you'd expect to hear on a show about consciousness science. I know that because I get plenty of emails asking me when I'm going to get back to NDE and psi research. But hey, there's an important through line here that I'd like to explore with you that really gets to the heart of what this show is all about, because my primary finding, if you will, from 350 episodes of Skeptico, is that we are more. That is, we're not biological robots in a meaningless universe that science tells us we are. We are more. So really, all questions beyond that are about what that more is, what that spirituality is, what that extended consciousness is. Where did it come from? What is its purpose? How does it function in our life and in our world? And while sure, these are the deepest, most profound questions that you could ask that people have been asking for thousands of years, and it's not like we're going to figure it out on a couple of podcast episodes, the topic is, I think, the most important topic we can talk about. And in this ongoing conversation that we're having, I think it's nice to keep it fresh and relevant with new things that are happening and look at how those might inform or further our understanding of what's really going on. And Pizzagate, that is the controversy surrounding the alleged occult-themed and pedophilia-themed emails of Hillary Clinton's top aide, John Podesta, are certainly fresh, and I would suggest that they're very relevant to some of these skeptical questions I was just talking about in some really important ways. Let me explain. First of all, the thing that really attracts me to looking at this is that it drives us right to the core of the evil question. And this is something I've been hammering on a little bit, and there's some interesting back and forth with some of my guests on that. But let me recap for a minute what I mean when I say the evil question. So step back and look at NDEs for a minute. So you have a near-death experience science, and the conclusion is consciousness survives death. That's the finding. Every significant near-death experience researcher has come to that conclusion. The data has come to that conclusion. Hundreds and hundreds of published studies. You've got to be there if you've really dug into the data, followed the data where it leads. But the next question about NDE research is, what does the experience seem to be telling us about the nature of this consciousness that survives death? And notice how I said that, because that's really the rub here. Because now we're saying with the NDE research about this experience is that this is an experience that people had when they were dead, or at least they had when their brain was so severely compromised that we can't really even talk about what kind of consciousness experience they would have been having inside of our existing neuro model about how the brain works. So with that, we take a look at the near-death experience, and we say, what can we start saying about it? And one of the conclusions that seems pretty clear, now not everyone sees it this way, but it sure as heck seems pretty clear, there appears to be a hierarchy to this consciousness. There's this incredible love. There's this good. There's light. There's also regret. There's pain. There's darkness. Now, again, for the atheistic science types, they were able to dance around the good, bad, light, dark stuff as long as they could tie it back to, well, that's part of the human condition. That's what the brain is just cooking up. But when we stepped over and said, no, wait a minute, these are experiences that our people are pulling back from a non-brain state, we are suddenly propelled right in the middle of this spirituality thing that I was saying at the beginning. And as we know, for the atheistic science types, this is a call to the battle stations. Put down this NDE research, or we're going to wind up with all the churchy folks stepping forward with their big I told you so, and a renewing of the science versus religion battle that we've been having for hundreds and hundreds of years. So back to Pizzagate. One of the great things about Pizzagate is that it really cuts through a lot of the ambiguity with the evil kind of moral good-bad question. Because sex crimes against children are evil, clearly evil. So in that way, it really makes clear the question, what is the nature of this evil? Is this evil something we just cook up in our consciousness as an illusion brain? Or does this evil tell us something about this hierarchical nature of consciousness? So that's one of the reasons Pizzagate is so interesting to me, and I think so relevant to Skeptico. But the other reason it's interesting to me from a Skeptico perspective has to do with this line we've been following with regard to conspiracy. And again, this is something that freaks people out whenever I talk about conspiracy and conspiracy theory. To me, it's just a natural consequence of doing these 350 shows. I mean, go all the way back to the beginning where I'm interviewing Dean Radin about why Steve Novella and prominent scientists like Ray Hyman are lying about his psi research. We'll bang against that problem long enough like we have, and you're forced to consider the possibility that there's a larger game afoot, and that's certainly the conclusion I've come to from not only the crazy way materialist science works, but also the way that research gets suppressed, misrepresented, misreported, and in particular I'm thinking about so many of the cases of near-death experience research that we've talked about on this show and chronicled how they've been intentionally misrepresented and distorted. But all that is just to defend this Skeptico ethos that has evolved, which is when you look at a topic, you have to look for the conspiracy. You have to follow the data first, but then second, you have to look for the conspiracy or you're liable to be blindsided. So one of the ways that I've come to gauge the conspiracy factor on these topics is to hear the pushback that I get from people who are opposed to a topic I may be covering. And now, mind you, that's not to suggest that the people who are pushing back are necessarily part of the conspiracy, if you will. I think in a lot of cases, they're more of a reflection of how the larger conspiracy is working its way through our culture. Now, you'll hear one example of this on the interview we have coming up with Bob Hamer, but another example I can give you, and it's really such a stark example, I can't resist throwing it out there, is an email that I got from my good friend at the very excellent Buddha at the Gas Pump show, Rick Archer. Now, Rick, as you know, has been on the show a couple times, and he's become somewhat of an unwitting muse for me, because on one hand, he drives me crazy with his party line, political, progressive, brainwashed worldview. But on the other hand, he does provide me with this kind of mirror for how some of this information is being processed by people who I like and have a lot of respect for and think are really intelligent, but think at the same time are totally missing the boat about what's really going on in terms of these deep spirituality questions and how they relate to our culture, how they fit into the conspiracy question. I gotta read for you the email that Rick sent me. after he listened to my interview with Daniel Pinchbeck, where I said, look, you know, if you don't think there's something to Pizzagate, then, well, you're just not paying attention. You're just not willing to look at the data. So Rick sent me this. Alex, you're a great guy, and I love you. You've created something wonderful with Skeptico. Okay, wait for it. Buying into this crap will cause sensible people to abandon your podcast in droves and leave you with an audience of wing nuts. It will also dissuade some important guests from coming on your show. You have an important role to play. Every time you voice your support for something like this, you erode and marginalize your legacy. Wow, legacy. Okay, so now my muse has spoken. So now we can talk about Pizzagate. And where I really want to try and get to with this is this deep spirituality angle that I was talking about at the beginning of the show. The whole connection back to Skeptico, to the NDE science, to the deeper questions about spirituality. Because this topic has all the elements we need to talk about the deep spirituality. It has the occult angle, which immediately throws so many people just running over to the Christian, religious, kind of, it's all of the devil kind of thing. And I just don't think that fits. On the other hand, people who are quick to defend the occult and the satanic and freedom of expression, they might want to take a deeper look at this nature of evil question we've been talking about. And then thirdly, like I always say, the people on the outside looking in are the atheistic science types. We can also throw our media, our intellectuals, our academics. We can throw them in the same boat. They're going to be on the outside of this issue looking in because none of it is real. Nothing related to spirituality, to forces beyond this physical realm influencing us, could have any reality to it. I mean, how ridiculous is that? How can we possibly make progress on this issue or any of these larger issues when we have this huge blockage of idiots standing in our way? But that's the problem at hand. Let's talk Pizzagate. And I want to try and break this down going forward in this already long introduction with the Skeptico ethos outline that I just kind of sketched out there. I don't know if you caught it, but it's a three-step process. First, follow the data wherever it leads. Second, look for the conspiracy. Three, find the deep spirituality. So here goes. Here's how I'd apply that to Pizzagate. Data point one, the timeline. It's November 4th, 2016, 4 days before the U.S. presidential election. Our friends at WikiLeaks release a huge batch of emails from John Podesta, super connected, super high up individual in the Hillary Clinton campaign. Now, these emails are a bombshell. They introduce us to this very weird occult practice called spirit cooking. They suggest John Podesta's ties to the occult and even sex crimes against children. And they suggest links between all these other folks, political folks, including this very influential guy in D.C. who happens to run a pizza shop. I won't mention his name since he's been well known to threaten people with really bad things when his name is mentioned, so I'm not going to mention his name. But anyways, the result of this WikiLeaks email dump is that it spawns this huge open source investigation on the internet where thousands and thousands of posters are out there looking through the public records and trying to find correlating data to support or in some cases refute the conclusions that people are drawing from these emails. So if you've never heard about open source investigations of this type, I mean, they're incredibly powerful and useful, and no one can deny the kind of information that they bring forward. Some of it turns out to be garbage. Some of it turns out to be really valuable. But hey, that's the nature of any kind of investigation. Let's bring it down to a concrete example. the Podesta emails contain all this coded speech about pizza and other things that everyone immediately was trying to figure out what it meant. Because it was clear these guys can't possibly be talking about their strange obsession with how thin you can slice pizza. But the challenge for people who got interested in doing this open source investigation was, can we find any data in the public domain that would add a little bit of substance to that suspicion? And they did. For example, people found child porn message boards where people were using coded speech, even using some of the same coded speech that they found in the Podesta emails. Other people dug through the Twitter and Instagram posts that these guys were connected with and found all this really bizarre, pedo-related, weird sexual stuff with all this pizza imagery attached to it. And I don't want to or need to get real graphic here because it's still all out there. It's very easy to find, and it's way, way over the top. So if that's the data for the pedo thing, we might ask, where does it lead? I mean, does it lead to a criminal conviction of sex crimes against children for these people? Clearly not. As you're about to hear in the interview that I've done with undercover FBI agent Bob Hamer, these are some of the most difficult crimes to get a conviction on. But I'd like to establish that there's a different criteria here when we come to trying to measure this, and let me throw it out there and see what you think. Would you let John Podesta babysit your children? Would one out of 1,000 people who isn't a registered sex offender let any of these people come close to any children they really care about? No frickin' way. You know that. I know that. And in this case, given that this is just the court of public opinion, is that equivalent to maybe a peer-reviewed study of whether there is any real connection between these guys and really, really inappropriate behavior involving children? Hey, before I get off the data part of this thing, let's talk about the data as it relates to the occult thing, because I haven't really even talked about that, because that is established. I mean, Mariana Abramović, the woman behind the whole spirit cooking thing, has publicly stated, yeah, this is occult stuff. This is trying to marshal and manage the energies of the spiritual world to get them to do things that you want them to do, whether you deem that to be good or bad. The problem with her admission, and why everyone wanted to reframe it and say, oh no, this is just performance art, which, by the way, she says in that statement, she goes, look, in an artistic setting, it's performance art, but all the rest of the time, it's occult magic. And anyone who's familiar with occult magic looks at it for 5 seconds and says, that's occult magic. The problem is, what do you make of that? What do you think about that? Do you think that's automatically satanic? Do you think that's automatically bad? Do you think that's automatically a whole bunch of things? And I want to put that to the side and instead focus on 3 things where I think that data leads. One is that politically, it's game over for anyone associated with that. As we said, you cannot like that, but you can't be involved in Crowleyan occult magic and be elected to high office. It doesn't work. So that's one conclusion we can definitely draw from the data, and that can therefore explain why people with political aspirations have done everything they can to twist the story around and get away from the story because it's game over. The second place it leads us, which I just alluded to, is that it is absolutely impossible for the atheist, secular, mainstream media to process the spiritual component of this. I mean, it's a blind spot. The woman has said, this is what I'm doing. And they just ignore it because it doesn't fit within their worldview. But the third place it leads us is maybe the most obvious if you can get past the first two, and that's that there are people who practice occult magic in order to affect things in this material world. And until we can at least acknowledge that straight on, then we're just going to kind of dance around in circles, which is what you've seen a lot of already. So if that's the data, and if that's where the data leads, then What's the conspiracy in the look for the conspiracy component of this analysis? Well, there's really two that we need to talk about. And the first one is rather obvious. These emails were released 4 days before the U.S. presidential election, and they sunk Hillary's already sinking ship. It's hard to believe that was an accident. I mean, when it comes to U.S. presidential elections, voters do not stray too far from the Christian motif, if you will. So any hints of occult-related spirit-cooking stuff 4 days before the election was probably enough to sink Hillary. If not, then certainly the innuendo of child sex abuse among her staff sealed the deal. So this is a conspiracy. I don't know who's behind it or what the real agenda was, but hey, that's part of a conspiracy we're not supposed to know. But there's a second conspiracy involved here that I want you to take a look at. Because while I've been rattling on about coded emails and open source investigations, some of you have been thinking, but wait a minute, Pizzagate is about some crazy guy who shot up a pizza restaurant. That's Pizzagate. And in a way, you're right, because that's certainly what Pizzagate has become. Any Google search will tell you that Pizzagate is number one, a debunked conspiracy theory, and number two, something that caused this wacky, dangerous conspiracy theorist to shoot up a pizza restaurant. End of story, move on. But there's a couple of problems with this narrative. First, none of this was ever really debunked. Podesta never explained his strangely coded emails, why he enjoyed graphic pedophilia-themed art, and why he had close friends like serial child molester Dennis Hassert around and continued to send him emails. And then there's the thousands and thousands of posts I was talking about and documents uncovered in the open source investigation. And interestingly, and I never hear people mention this, but that was all in the process of being shut down a couple days before the shooting, when Reddit, without any precedent or explanation, closed this enormous Pizzagate thread that had been accumulating. Then, a few days later, on December 4th, there was the shooting in the pizza restaurant, and most folks got the message, and if they're investigating Pizzagate, they went running for cover, and who can blame them, right? So let me, with that, wrap up this introduction and move on to my interview today with ex-undercover FBI agent Bob Hamer. And I'm pretty confident that you'll see how this relates to all this crazy stuff I've been talking about here. But just in case you don't, I have a couple of additional thoughts that I'll throw out there in the wrap-up after the interview. Here's my interview with Bob Hamer. Today we welcome Bob Hamer to Skeptico. Bob was a special agent with the FBI for 26 years. He was also a judge advocate in the Marine Corps. And as an attorney, he tried cases ranging from murder to petty theft. He's also an accomplished and award-winning author. He's here today to talk about his book, The Last Undercover, The True Story of an FBI Agent's Dangerous Stance with Evil. And also, we may talk about his work with the organization Veterans for Child Rescue. Bob, welcome to Skeptico. Thank you so much for joining me.
Alex, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
So would you like to briefly add to that bio that I sketched out again? Maybe you can fill in some of the details, particularly with some of your undercover work you did while in the FBI.
Yeah, I was really fortunate. I found my niche in the FBI. As you mentioned, I spent 4 years on active duty in the Marine Corps, and I was a judge advocate. I was a lawyer. I laugh because the Marines didn't consider me a Marine and the lawyers didn't consider me a lawyer. And even though I'd gone through the officer candidate school and the 6-month officer basic school, I was assigned, and I had already attended law school, but I was a judge advocate. And the Marines were going to allow me to change my MOS if I wanted to stay in. And quite frankly, I hated being a lawyer. I mean, every case we had, it was always a procedural issue. I kind of grew up in that Perry Mason generation where I assumed everyone was innocent. And at some point during the middle of the trial, some guy came barreling through the back door going, I did it. But everybody was guilty. It was just a matter of whether procedurally you could convict them. So whether you were on the prosecution side of the table or the defense side, it was whether the search was legal, whether the confession is admissible. And I was bored stiff in the courtroom. Fortunately for me, the FBI was looking for lawyers, and I applied and got in, and man, I loved it. And I quickly, within about 6 months of being within the FBI, I had my first undercover assignment, and man, I was hooked then. I had that adrenaline rush, and I spent many of my 26 years in the Bureau in undercover capacity. So I've played the role of a contract killer. I've been a high-level drug dealer. I've been a street-level drug user. I've been a international arms dealer. I mean, I played all the different roles. I always said I'd been to about 12 different personalities and enjoyed every one of them.
Fascinating. So tell us in particular about this book and the case that's behind it, The Last Undercover.
Yeah, you know, I had no desire to ever write a book. I say that a lot of defense counsel claimed I was a great fiction writer, but they were always referring to my affidavits that I wrote against their clients. But I really didn't have any desire to write a book. But I got involved in an organization called NAMBLA, and it's the North American Man-Boy Love Association.
You got involved through your work as a special agent with the FBI.
Yeah. As an FBI agent. And a lot of people always thought it was a joke. It was an episode on South Park. I know Howard Stern used to talk about it. And I believe people thought, oh, there can't be such an organization that exists like this. Well, there really was. My involvement with NAMBLA originally started sort of by the back door. One of the fun things about working undercover is you have to assume a variety of roles, which means you've got to be strong enough and smart enough to play a role that is believable. So at various times, I mean, at one point I was kind of an expert on Western art. I had forgotten everything about it that I learned for that particular undercover assignment. I've had to learn about specific weapons or about investments or about real estate, just depending upon what the undercover role was. Well, in this particular case, the FBI had arrested a guy back in Knoxville, Tennessee, who had been involved in child pornography. And when they searched his computer, they found that he had taken video of himself having sex with boys over in Thailand. When they investigated further, they found out that he had gone over to Thailand as part of an organized sex tour that was put together by a travel agent in Los Angeles. At the time, I was an FBI agent in Los Angeles. Los Angeles was tasked by headquarters to investigate this undercover agent. So I was called in because I was a certified undercover agent to work this travel agent. And, I like to joke when the case agent first approached me, it was, hey, we got this we need an undercover agent to involve sex tours to Thailand. And I said, hey, sign me up. If the government's going to pay for my massages over there, I'll do it. Well, then he said, no, this is for boy lovers, BLs. These are for men who are sexually attracted to boys. And these men fly from the United States over to Thailand to engage in sex acts with these kids. So I signed up. You have to understand, let me back up just a little bit so your listeners understand. In the FBI, it's not like television. The supervisor doesn't walk out into the squad bay and says, hey, who wants to be a pedophile today? And, some guy raises his hand and says, okay, you're going to go undercover as a pedophile. In the Bureau, there were probably 12,000, 13,000 agents, depending on what period of time we're talking about. Only those that are certified to work undercover can do the undercover work. So typically, there may only be 100 to 150 agents that are certified to work undercover. Not every FBI agent wants to work undercover. A lot of great agents have no desire to work undercover. Some agents that apply for the undercover program can't get through the initial screening process. Then there's a two-week in-service that the Bureau wants you to think it's like BUDS training or boot camp or Marine Corps Officer Candidate School. It's not, but a lot of guys can't get to that two-week undercover in-service that they have because it's stressful and they want to see how you react to stress. And then guys that graduate that are certified to work undercover may only work one or two assignments because they don't like the hours, they don't like the pressure, they move up in management. So at any one time, there may only be 100 to 150 people that are certified to work undercover, and there weren't a whole lot of us on the east or on the west coast. So I like to joke that toward the end of my career, I was getting all the IOU assignments. If they needed somebody that was impotent, old, or ugly, they were calling on me, and that's how I got involved. I was contacted because I was a certified undercover agent. Do you want to work this travel agent case?
Well, let's talk about this topic a little bit, though, because I understand you're joking with it, and we gotta kind of lighten it up a little bit because sex crimes against children is something that a lot of people just won't talk about. I mean, if you want to clear a room, talk about 10-year-old boys being raped by 50-year-old men. But I guess I think that, you know, the whole reason we're having this dialogue here, and I suspect that part of the reason why you wrote this book is that it is something we have to face, or we wind up with all sorts of craziness where otherwise intelligent, well-meaning people are saying some just rather ridiculous stuff that sounds like it's in defense of this behavior or somehow normalizing it or minimizing it. Do you have any sense, do you have any feeling after going through this that does that bug you when you see that going on, or do you see that going on?
Oh, you're absolutely right. You're spot on with your evaluation. The book was written because I was so disgusted by this undercover assignment. I've had more dangerous assignments. I've had a contract put out on my life. I've shot people. I've been shot at. I was the undercover agent in the L.A. Mafia family case. There is no L.A. Mafia anymore. We wiped out the top 15 members of the L.A. Mafia. I mean, I've been involved in some pretty dangerous undercover assignments, but this was my most disgusting assignment, and this was my most difficult assignment. And having spent 3 years in the organization, not on a daily basis when I was meeting with these people, but over a three-year period, conversing with them, meeting with them face-to-face, writing letters to those that were in prison, and eventually convicting 8 members of the group's inner circle, I was so disgusted by what I had seen, so disturbed by the communications that I had with these men, listening to them tell about what they had done to kids, what they wanted to do to little boys. I needed to write about this, maybe for catharsis on my part, but really to expose the world, to let the world know about this boy lover agenda. And the book, I mean, a lot of people can't read the book. You're absolutely right. It's like, oh, I want to bury my head in the sand and I don't even want to talk about this. And now you are seeing this whole pedophilia is becoming the next civil rights issue.
Yeah. And that's strange. And I think I want to explore that for a minute, because I do get the sense that there are some, you know, intelligent, otherwise intelligent, well-meaning people who just kind of gets vapor lock on this. I'll give you a small example. You know, I was working on an interview with the show, and I was in contact with a woman who was the co-author with someone who'd been on the show and I like and respect. And we started talking a little bit about this prominent political figure that was linked to this kind of pedophilia sex crime thing. And the net result is, she says, I think that what goes on between people in the bedroom should be private. And I was like, no, wait a minute. No sane person equates that statement with pedophilia. Yet I get the sense, and I'd like to get your view on this, that it's kind of been mixed up in our culture and in the way the media communicates it, to where people actually kind of say things like that without really kind of thinking it through.
Well, I agree with you. I hope that she wasn't thinking it through. But as I saw in NAMBLA, now you have to understand the whole purpose of the North American Man-Boy Love Association. It is a 501c, I think. I shouldn't say that. It is an organization that is protected by the First Amendment because on paper, their mission is to abolish age of consent laws.
Explain that a little bit.
Okay, yeah, so your listeners understand. Most nations, every state in the United States has a minimum age of consent law. In other words, if an adult has sex with an 18-year-old, if a 50-year-old man has sex with an 18-year-old, that's okay if the age of consent law is 18. Now, what you see in NAMBLA was their mission was to abolish the age of consent law. They wanted to just do away with it completely and say, look, if two consenting people are doing this, then it's okay. Now, let's take it one step further. When you hear that on the surface, two consenting people, similar to what your guest said, you know, what people do in the bedroom is okay. So when we're talking about two consenting people, we're talking about two 30-year-olds or a 40-year-old and a 20-year-old. You know, that's one thing. NAMBLA talks about intergenerational sex. So you think about a 50-year-old and a 30-year-old. Okay, that's fine. But they want to abolish all age of consent. So they believe that as long as you're consenting, regardless of your age, it should be okay.
Bob, let me just interject two things here so we don't get too far afield. I want people to understand the case that you investigated men, like 40, 50-year-old men who were planning to have sex with 10-year-old boys, right?
Exactly. Yes.
So you know, I mean, we can get into the legal technicalities and stuff like that. I mean, I think we gotta kind of come down to that and understand, you know, there's all this gray area about consent, and we hear about these horror stories of, you know, people who do wind up in a situation that we can have empathy for. I'm a dad. I don't know about you. I have four kids. I remember when my boys were 10-year-olds. I remember when my girls were 10-year-olds. The idea of someone raping them at that age or somehow tricking them and, you know, at that, I mean, it's soul crushing. It's psyche crushing. I mean, so one, to be clear, that's what you were investigating. You weren't getting into 15-year-olds or 16-year-olds.
I wasn't getting into 15-year-olds. I'm just trying to give the listeners an idea of where the line is drawn.
And the other thing is that the NAMBLA thing is bullshit, right? I mean, it was bullshit. They're not really interested in that.
NAMBLA, during my 3 years, there was no effort at any time to abolish age of consent laws. There was no legislative effort. There was no movement to write letters to your congressman or your legislators. All this organization was designed to do was for like-minded men to get together and to talk about where they could go to have sex with little boys and how they could seduce little boys. That was the whole purpose of this organization, even though on paper it was to abolish the age of consent laws.
That kind of leads into what I really wanted to accomplish, along with telling people about this book and these other organizations that you're a part of to try and help improve this situation, is I want to tap into your expertise and experience in working on these crimes. I mean, be clear that they're crimes. We're talking about crimes. But maybe to dispel some of these myths and at the same time identify some of the patterns that go along with this criminal behavior. Tell folks about the Toys R Us story.
Yeah, when I first joined the organization, it was to provide me backstopping for this travel agent case that we were investigating. So I was trying to figure out, okay, this is the boy lover movement. I've got to think like them. I've got to talk like them. I've got to convince this travel agent that I'm one of them. So I joined NAMBLA. I mean, during my research, I come across NAMBLA. It's an organization. You can send in $35, and now you're essentially a card-carrying member. So I joined the organization. Soon after I had joined, I received some emails. We have prisoners. We have members that are in prison. Can you send Christmas cards to our imprisoned members? So I sent Christmas cards. Then it was like, well, we have a pen pal program. Can you write letters? So I started corresponding with some of these members. And the correspondence, for the most part, was disgusting. Now I find out that they were having their national meeting in San Francisco. Now, you have to understand, Alex, when this first organization first started, they had very open meetings. I mean, they were meeting in libraries and public buildings because it was deemed part of this sexual revolution and a movement that was part of the sexual revolution. They were marching in the gay pride parades and openly marching in those parades. Then there was a groundswell that forced this group to go essentially underground. So these meetings, I wanted to go to this meeting in San Francisco. I was told, no, you haven't been a member long enough and you have to be sponsored by another member. Usually it takes 3 years before we'll invite you to one of our meetings, because they'd had so much exposure, so much adverse exposure in the past. When I finally get invited, and what happened was I was working on the Joint Terrorism Task Force, but I was still in this organization. I was corresponding with the members. I was sending them Christmas cards. I wrote articles for their magazine, the NAMBLA Bulletin. All of a sudden, I get invited to their New York meeting that they were having the next year. So San Francisco, I wasn't invited to. Now when they have their New York meeting, I'm invited to that, and it's over Veterans Day weekend. I go back to New York. We meet at Grand Central Station. Now, as I mentioned before, I've targeted some pretty tough organizations, the mafia, Asian organized crime groups, Russian organized crime groups, street gangs. I've never met a more paranoid group than this. So our initial meeting on Friday night, we were to meet at Grand Central Station at the dining concourse. They weren't going to announce where the meeting was taking place until that night. They didn't want to give law enforcement any chance to set up and raid the meeting or take photographs of those members who were going into the meeting and everything. So that's their security was that tight. Well, that night, while we were in the Grand Central Station, congregating around, the kind of the leader of the group, they don't have a president, but kind of the guy who's take charge of the organization, was a fellow named Peter Melzer. He was a school teacher back in New York City before he got fired because of his associations with NAMBLA. He asked if we want to take a tour of Times Square. So we begin this walk from Grand Central Station down to Times Square. And as we are getting closer, I can begin to feel the excitement. I mean, it's like going to a USC football game, or you could sense the sort of this excitement on the part of the members. And all of a sudden, we come to Toys R Us. And these guys, as we walk in, they run to the railing. And Toys R Us is closed now in Times Square, but they had a 60-foot indoor Ferris wheel. And these men ran to the railing and stood at the railing and watched these boys going around on the Ferris wheel and pointing out the different boys based upon what clothes they were wearing and talking about, oh, that kid in the number 32 jersey, this is what I'd like to do with them. And we're getting pretty explicit with the sex acts that they wanted to do to these little boys. And I say this, had I not been undercover, had I walked past them and heard these men talking like that, I would have thrown them off the railing. I mean, it was so disgusting what they were doing. And it demonstrated to me that parents, well-meaning parents who had brought their children to a public arena, was providing eye candy for these pedophiles and these sick perverts, talking about what they really want to do to these little boys.
And this is not a crime.
No, it was not a crime. They were not acting out upon it. They were just saying what they wanted to do.
You see, because I think we can spend a lot of time and energy worrying about what's a crime? Now, I realize as an FBI, special agent for the FBI, that's your job. As an attorney working with the district attorney, that's your job. You know, like you said earlier about one of the things you disliked about being a lawyer, it seemed like you spent all your time on procedural issues. But so I want to get your opinion kind of a little bit outside of your experience as an FBI agent, but this distinction between kind of common sense, you know, like common sense says, hey, I'd throw these guys off the rail. I mean, these are disgusting people that are going to act out these crimes against these defenseless kids versus I understand your role as an FBI agent, but in the terms of public discourse, I think sometimes we get hung up on proving a crime, which is what we should do before we incarcerate somebody, versus the court of public opinion when the evidence is highly suggestive that these individuals or a particular individual is involved in this kind of behavior. Do you have a sense for where I'm going with that?
Well, and I think it's important that we understand what these people are doing and how they're thinking, because as we mentioned just a little earlier in this interview, there is a movement afoot to describe pedophilia as a civil rights issue and the next civil rights issue. And so there's a movement to remove pedophilia from the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, the DSM-5.
Right.
Just as homosexuality was removed in the 60s, I believe. Now there is a movement afoot by professionals. This isn't just somebody that doesn't know what they're talking about. These are psychiatrists, psychologists with advanced degrees that believe that we should remove this as a mental disease and disorder.
So I'm a little bit familiar with that. My wife is a forensic psychologist, and she actually has worked in prison. One thing I just wanted to throw in about her work that she educated me on, you know, you hear about how sex offenders are treated in prison, and I wasn't sure whether that was myth or not. And I know from my wife, she said, no, that is like totally real. And maybe you want to talk about that too. But I mean, talk about, you can't even say low person on the totem pole in prison. I mean, these people are at risk for losing their life. That's how much they're loathed by even the prison population, right?
Well, in some prisons, it's true. The kinder, gentler federal system now, we've actually established in Butner, North Carolina, at the federal prison there is where a lot of the sex offenders go, so that they are kind of housed in the same arena, one for safety, but also for counseling and rehabilitation, allegedly. Mm-hmm. But we used to joke when we would arrest a sex offender, we'd say, you know, we ought to let him, he'd probably agree to plead guilty to bank robbery for 10 years than a sex offense for 5 years, because he'd rather have the inmates believe he was a bank robber than a sex offender, particularly a child molester.
So let me touch on another thing that's kind of part of the story that you told, and maybe you can elaborate on it, but another characteristic we see is that these folks like to associate with each other. They like to get together with other pedophiles, even if it's just to exchange images of, you know, child porn, or if it's to exchange, you know, techniques in terms of how to get kids and stuff like that. I mean, you're talking about, maybe you want to talk to this, but you wind up working with a diverse, if you will, group of individuals across a political spectrum, across a outwardly spiritual perspective. I mean, speak to that. You know what I'm getting at.
Yeah, what I found in this organization was it ran the gamut of the socioeconomic perspectives. I met Mensa members, I met the illiterate, I met wealthy people, I met people that were on welfare. One of the guys that we ended up convicting was a dentist. He actually flew to the meeting in Miami in his own plane. We arrested a PhD psychologist. So of the people that we convicted in our operation, we had a PhD psychologist who worked at two Chicago area hospitals, a dentist from Dallas. We had three special ed teachers. We had an ordained minister We had a blue-collar worker, and we had a bodybuilder, personal fitness trainer. So it did run that gamut. Now, in my communications with imprisoned AMLA members, I mean, I had airline pilots, school administrators, ministers, barely literate people, foster parents. I mean, it just ran the entire educational gamut and economic gamut.
You know, you talked about all the correspondence that you did with these inmates and these other members. Can you speak to anything about, because you did speak to the extent to which they go to hide this behavior, because not only is it criminal, but the scorn that it gets just from the public is, I mean, you'll have, I'm sure you've worked on other cases with mafia organized crime where people are more or less kind of proud as long as they don't get caught of the fact that they have this association. Not so much the case here. So can you speak to coded speech, coded emails, coded communication, that kind of thing?
Yeah, you know, we did have in some of the communication, one of the guys that we ended up convicting was a former special ed teacher. He ended up getting 30 years in our investigation. But when they searched his trash, they found communications like, I saw a sidewinder today, like a size 8. And we believe that he was speaking in code when he was writing it. In the letters that I was getting back and forth with these guys in the emails, they were talking in code. In fact, part of our sting was when they had originally set it up, they wanted to go down to Costa Rica to see if they could find some boys down there. Well, the FBI we wanted to be in charge of this, so I told them that I was aware of a place in Ensenada, down below Ensenada, that we could go. So it was always referred to as a fishing trip that we were going to, as opposed to going down to have little boys. But yeah, so there was coded messages that they used in their discussions with each other and in our written communication.
Bob, let's talk about Evil. The title of your book is The Last Undercover, The True Story, An FBI Agent's Dangerous Dance with Evil. You're a Christian. I am not. But I believe there's evil. I believe there's evil both in this world and beyond this world, whatever we understand that to be. Here's the question, though. Do you think our inability, our apparent inability to deal with that idea that there is an evil, or even to address these topics from some kind of spiritual perspective, spiritual dimension, do you think that prevents us or inhibits us from really making progress on some kind of solution, some kind of better way of dealing with this?
Well, I think with a lot of issues, that's true. We're afraid to speak out because it's not politically correct or because we're viewed as being judgmental. I do believe there's certain conduct that is evil and should be labeled as such. And we shouldn't be afraid to talk about it. I mean, when you look at it, we're kind of going back to this whole pedophilia and making that a civil rights issue. I think once that is made a civil rights issue, it's going to make a huge change as to how this is viewed. Who would have guessed 3 or 4 years ago that we would be talking about transsexuals and men being allowed to go into the restrooms of women? Now we talk about that not because of transsexual, but because it's a civil right, because the idea that, well, there are people that are this way, that are born this way, we shouldn't be judgmental because this is the way they are created, so we should allow this. That's what the whole movement is with this pedophilia. As I see it, it's because they're saying, well, people are born this way or people choose to be this way, and who are we to judge? We can look at other societies where this is okay, and it's and I saw this in NAMBLA. It's they are blaming a moralistic society for making this behavior that was so prevalent in the Greek society, in ancient Greek society, and in societies even today in other essentially third world countries where this is permitted, that so it should be permitted here in the United States.
Right. So I think we're kind of almost there on the same page. I mean, there is this kind of secular atheist, really nonsense. I mean, to 90% of people, if you go and poll people any way you can, 90% of them say, in some general sense, I believe in God, whatever that means, or I believe that there's a good evil, that there's some kind of morality, you know? And I don't know the statistics, but I'm sure that if you polled those same people about whether or not there's a morality issue with 50-year-old men having sex with 10-year-old boys, I think you'd have the same kind of numbers, you know, 99%. So this is some kind of nonsense that I don't know how it gets advanced, because no sane person is thinking that this is a civil rights issue or that this secular atheist kind of, you know, there is no possible way that we could get to the bottom of whether there's a right or wrong. This issue in particular really brings it into focus, because you couldn't get 1 out of 100 people to buy that.
At some point, the majority, the vast majority of us recognize perversion. In this particular case, of the 8 members that we convicted, 7 that agreed to go on this little jaunt down to Mexico, every one of them spoke of having anal sex with 10 to 12 year old boys. That's what they wanted to do. I don't know how anyone, just as you had said earlier, Alex, how can anyone say that is not evil, that that's okay, if the boys say it's okay? How do you even justify that?
And I'd go one step further, and I don't want to push you into saying this, but I think it's evil in this spiritual way that we don't totally understand. I mean, you and I might not see totally eye to eye on that, but I think there's a spiritual force here at play, and I think it's influencing, and it's not just people who identify as being satanic ritual, satanic kind of abusers. It's people who don't identify to that, but are still somehow being influenced to engage in this behavior. Now, that's my opinion. I don't want to hang that on you, but I think until we are at least willing to explore that possibility, I just think we'd have zero chance of really getting our arms around this.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm not going to lead you into that one, unless you have anything to say about that.
No, huh?
Okay, so one last thing on this case, and then I want to talk about some of the other groups you're involved with and actually trying to make a difference. But I know this is a horribly serious issue, but I got such a chuckle out of the way you kind of introduced, I guess you call it gallows humor in some of this. You're a fantastic writer, very accomplished. You haven't only written this book, but you've written other very successful books, and you're very accomplished at that. But you wound up writing articles for these folks to somehow work your way into the system. What is this one, castration myth or miracle? I don't know what the title is, but I know when I heard it, I just couldn't stop laughing.
Yeah, castration myth or magic. And it was just, part of it is, you have to understand, and you've seen this, I'm sure your wife sees this with what she's been through in forensic psychology, but humor is a great stress reliever. And so I use that, and I believe that as a leader, it's important that you provide humor and a relaxed atmosphere in which you can work. And whether it's gallows humor, whether it's combat humor, whatever it is, you just have to laugh to allow this. So that was, yeah, I wrote that. One of the things I used to do in most of my undercover assignments, I use music, and I would play. I had an international weapons case where we were dealing with a $60 million conspiracy for shoulder fire missiles. about 6 or 7 times at the main target of our investigation when he got into my undercover car. Every time he got into the car, I had it cued to the Charlie Daniels song, Uneasy Rider. And the line that you hear on the first line on every undercover tape that you hear, it's Charlie Daniels saying, "Don't you know it? This man's a spy. He's undercover agent for the FBI." And that's a line right from Uneasy Rider. And when I had the bad guys in the car, I would be playing Folsom Prison Blues and Jailhouse Rock. Anything that had a prison theme, I would play it. When one of the NAMBLA members got into my car, and he was actually an ordained minister, I had it cued to a Charlie Daniels song called Simple Man. And it essentially, the line is, "We should take these child molesters out to the swamp, put them on their knees and tie them to a stump and let the alligators and the bugs do all the rest." So I was always trying to had my own soundtrack when I was doing it. I bought 2 kilos of crystal meth from a guy, and I had it timed perfectly. So just as he was handing it to me and explaining it and the details of the case, I had Harold Melville in the Blue Notes singing, "If you don't know me by now, you'll never ever know me." So,
so Bob, you've written this book, amongst other books that you've written, The Last Undercover. People can find it at bobhamer.net. You're also, tell us a little bit about your work with this group, Veterans for Child Rescue, and what you're trying to do there.
Yeah, I've known Craig Sawyer for several years now, and have always appreciated his work. I'm sure most of your listeners are familiar with him. If not, he's former member of SEAL Team 6. He was a Marine first, then a member of SEAL Team 6, been a U.S. Air Marshal, involved with some television shows, both as a technical advisor. He was involved in a series in which they went after predators, animal predators, over in Africa. And he just has a passion to save children and to help children. And he started this group. It's vetsforchildrescue.org. And he wants to expose this whole issue of child abuse. And what we're finding is that, you know, there are people that are getting away with this because of their position in society. And obviously there have been recent people coming out in Hollywood talking about the pedophile issue in Hollywood and the child abuse that some are getting caught and some aren't. And I think Craig wants to shine a light on this whole child abuse issue. It should be our mission. It should be each of our missions to protect our children. As trite as it may sound, they are our future. And if we don't protect them, who is? And so that's what he wants to do with Vets for Child Rescue. It's a 501c. You can donate to it. The idea is that he wants to start first with a documentary, identifying the issues, and then hope that this can be picked up and go into a series where they would be targeting pedophiles and exposing them.
Well, it's important work, and as we said early on, I mean, you're to be commended. Well, your service is great, but then, you know, your willingness to go, to be that guy that when they came out to the pool there and said, "He'll take this case," to take it on, because it's not easy. I'm sure it crushes a lot, soul crushes a lot of people, so that's awesome.
Well, you know, Alex, this was, as I said earlier, this is my most difficult case. This was because it really, I've posed as a contract killer. I've posed as a drug dealer. And when you're a contract killer, I mean, you don't care whether, if someone's hiring me, they don't care whether I'm Republican or Democrat, where I like football or the ballet. They just want to know that I can, you know, if they're hiring me to kill someone, that I can do it. In my undercover role, let me make that clear to your listeners. The same with a drug dealer. Drug dealers don't really care what your beliefs are, as long as you have the money to purchase the drugs. But in this particular case, in the NAMBLA case, I had to think like them. I had to talk like them. I had to act like them. A good example was the dentist that I talked about. He bragged about how he had taped a Sylvan Learning commercial, and not because he thought it could help his kids learn how to read better. It was because he was in love with the little boy on the commercial. These members love the movie Lord of the Flies because it was a bunch of little boys running around in their underwear. So I had to think like that, and so it made it very difficult. I'm a raging heterosexual. I've been married for 43 years. I've never cheated on my wife. But one of the meetings we had down in Boca Raton, Florida, it was a beautiful evening. Women were running around in beachwear. I mean, gorgeous women. And I couldn't look at them because I was a boy lover. I was a BL. And while we were sitting out there on the outdoor patio of a restaurant and these women are parading up and down the street, these guys are going, oh my gosh, look at that kid in the blue shirt. This is what I want to do to him. Let's play the dating game. Who do you want to ask out? You know, who do you want to do? Who do you want to do? And that's what they were talking about. So that whole line, I'm sitting there. I have to be focused like them and think like them, and I can't get caught slipping. Now, I will say on that particular day, they were arguing about where we should go to dinner. I mean, it was a group of us that were down there. Where do we go to dinner? I did suggest Hooters, and I said, you know, I think that we should go to Hooters because the cops would figure no boy lovers would ever go to Hooters, but I was voted down on that suggestion.
Fantastic. Our guest again has been Bob Hamer. The book you might want to check out is The Last Undercover. You can get it, of course, on Amazon, and you can check out Bob's website, bobhamer.net. Bob, fantastic. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Alex, I appreciate you having me on, and thanks for talking about this topic. It's not one that a lot of people want to talk about, and it's one that we need to know. We need to protect our children, and I appreciate you doing this.
Thanks again to Bob Hamer for joining me today on Skeptico. I said I'd have a couple of additional thoughts. Let me throw those out in the form of a question, the kind that I usually tee up at the end of these interviews. Do you think people are ever influenced by evil spirits? Now, I know that question's pretty stark and it probably throws people off, but that's why I took 20 minutes of an intro to explain why that question is, I think, a natural result of all these shows, all these investigations we've done of consciousness, of near-death experience, of psi research, of all that. At the end of the day, one of the questions that falls out is, if there is this extended consciousness realm, in what ways is it influencing this material world? Again, the advantage of looking at Pizzagate or Bob's case with NAMBLA is that I think we can all agree in these cases, we're looking at evil. The moral ambiguity question is really off the table. There are some people that do really, really evil things. And I suspect that there's an as below, so above kind of thing going on here too. So we know there's evil in this realm, in this dimension. I'd suggest, and I think the evidence seems to suggest, that evil extends beyond this dimension to these other extended consciousness realms in a way that I don't understand and I don't think anyone has a total grip on. But hey, that's why we're here. That's why you're listening to this show. That's why I'm doing that show. Let's put our heads together and see if we can at least nudge a tiny bit closer towards something that looks like an answer, something that comforts us or at least allows us to move forward in our lives and make better decisions about what path we want to take on this journey that we're all on together. Hate to get super new agey spiritual, but I don't know where else you can go with this kind of stuff. So there's a ton of questions in there. Pull them apart, if you will, and shoot me back an email. Let me know what you think. Join the Skeptico Forum. Talk to other like-minded people. See what you think. And if you like this show, please share it with your friends. Please share it in other places. I'd love to get as many people as I can into this conversation because I think it's an important one. And stick with me. I have some very interesting shows coming up. I know I always say that, but I really do this time. It's great having you all along with me. A lot of times I do feel like you're right here listening and talking with me when I do these shows, and that's a really, really cool feeling. Until next time, take care and bye for now.